thus requires two things. A means of determining the distance of a given astronomical object, so that we know how far back in time we are looking, and a means of determining the speed with which the object is receding from us, so that we know the rate of spatial expansion at that moment in the past. The latter ingredient is easier to come by. Just as the pitch of a police car's siren drops to lower tones as it rushes away from us, the frequency of vibration of the light emitted by an astronomical source also drops as the object rushes away. And since the light emitted by atoms like hydrogen, helium, and oxygen, atoms that are among the constituents of stars, quasars, and galaxies, has been carefully studied under laboratory conditions, a precise determination of the object's speed can be made by examining how the light we receive differs from that seen in the lab. But the former ingredient, a method for determining precisely how far away an object is, has proven to be the astronomer's headache. The farther away something is, the dimmer you expect it to appear. But turning this simple observation into a quantitative measure is difficult. To judge the distance to an object by its apparent brightness, you need to know its intrinsic brightness, how bright it would be were it right next to you. And it is difficult to determine the intrinsic brightness of an object billions of light-years away. The general strategy is to seek a species of heavenly bodies that, for fundamental reasons of astrophysics, always burn with a standard, dependable brightness. If space were dotted with glowing 100-watt light bulbs, that would do the trick, since we could easily determine a given bulb's distance on the basis of how dim it appears, although it would be a challenge to see 100-watt bulbs from significantly far away. But, as space isn't so endowed, what can play the role of standard brightness light bulbs? Or, in astronomy speak, what can play the role of standard candles? Through the years, astronomers have studied a variety of possibilities, but the most successful candidate to date is a particular class of supernova explosions. When stars exhaust their nuclear fuel, the outward pressure from nuclear fusion in the star's core diminishes, and the star begins to implode under its own weight. As the star's core crashes in on itself, its temperature rapidly rises, sometimes resulting in an enormous explosion that blows off the star's outer layers in a brilliant display of heavenly fireworks. Such an explosion is known as a supernova. For a period of weeks, a single exploding star can burn as bright as a billion suns. It's truly mind-boggling. A single star burning as bright as almost an entire galaxy. Different types of stars, of different sizes, with different atomic abundances and so on, give rise to different kinds of supernova explosions. But for many years, astronomers have realized that certain supernova explosions always seem to burn with the same intrinsic brightness. These are type 1A supernova explosions. In a type 1A supernova, a white dwarf star, a star that has exhausted its supply of nuclear fuel, but has insufficient mass to ignite a supernova explosion on its own, sucks the surface material from a nearby companion star. When the dwarf star's mass reaches a particular critical value, about 1.4 times that of the Sun, it undergoes a runaway nuclear reaction that causes the star to go supernova. Since such supernova explosions occur when the dwarf star reaches the same critical mass, the characteristics of the explosion, including its overall intrinsic brightness, are largely the same from episode to episode. Moreover, since supernovae, unlike 100-watt light bulbs, are so fantastically powerful, not only do they have a standard, dependable brightness, but you can also see them clear across the universe. They are thus prime candidates for standard candles. In the 1990s, two groups of astronomers, one led by Saul Perlmutter at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and the other led by Brian Schmidt at the Australian National University, set out to determine the deceleration, and hence the total mass energy, of the universe by measuring the recession speeds of type 1A supernovae. Identifying a supernova as being of type 1A is fairly straightforward because the light their explosions generate follows a distinctive pattern of steeply rising, then gradually falling intensity. But actually catching a type 1A supernova in the act is no small feat, since they happen only about once every few hundred years in a typical galaxy. Nevertheless, through the innovative technique of simultaneously observing thousands of galaxies with wide-field-of-view telescopes, the teams were able to find nearly four dozen Type 1A supernovae at various distances from Earth. After painstakingly determining the distance and recessional velocities of each, both groups came to a totally unexpected conclusion. Ever since the universe was about 7 billion years old, its expansion rate has not been decelerating. Instead, the expansion rate has been speeding up. The groups concluded that the expansion of the universe slowed down for the first 7 billion years after the initial outward burst, much like a car slowing down as it approaches a highway toll booth. This was as expected. But the data revealed that, like a driver who hits the gas pedal after gliding through the easy pass lane, the expansion of the universe has been accelerating ever since. The expansion rate of space 7 billion years ATB was less than the expansion rate 8 billion years ATB, which was less than the expansion rate 9 billion years ATB, and so on, all of which are less than the expansion rate today. The expected deceleration of spatial expansion has turned out to be an unexpected acceleration. But how could this be? Well, the answer provides the corroborating second opinion regarding the missing 70% of mass energy that physicists had been seeking. The missing 70%. If you cast your mind back to 1917, and Einstein's introduction of a cosmological constant, you have enough information to suggest how it might be that the universe is accelerating. Ordinary matter and energy give rise to ordinary attractive gravity, which slows spatial expansion. But as the universe expands and things get increasingly spread out, this cosmic gravitational pull, while still acting to slow the expansion, gets weaker. And this sets us up for the new and unexpected twist. If the universe should have a cosmological constant, and if its magnitude should have just the right small value, up until about 7 billion years ATB, its gravitational repulsion would have been overwhelmed by the usual gravitational attraction of ordinary matter, yielding a net slowing of expansion in keeping with the data. But then, as ordinary matter spread out and its gravitational pull diminished, the repulsive push of the cosmological constant, whose strength does not change as matter spreads out, would have gradually gained the upper hand, and the era of decelerated spatial expansion would have given way to a new era of accelerated expansion. In the late 1990s, such reasoning and an in-depth analysis of the data led both the Perlmutter group and the Schmidt group to suggest that Einstein had not been wrong some 8 decades earlier when he introduced a cosmological constant into the gravitational equations. The universe, they suggested, does have a cosmological constant. Its magnitude is not what Einstein proposed, since he was chasing a static universe in which gravitational attraction and repulsion matched precisely. And these researchers found that for billions of years, repulsion has dominated. But, that detail notwithstanding, should the discovery of these groups continue to hold up under the close scrutiny and follow-up studies now underway, Einstein will have once again seen through to a fundamental feature of the universe. one that this time took more than 80 years to be confirmed experimentally. The recession speed of a supernova depends on the difference between the gravitational pull of ordinary matter and the gravitational push of the dark energy supplied by the cosmological constant. Taking the amount of matter, both visible and dark, to be about 30% of the critical density, the supernova researchers concluded that the accelerated expansion they had observed required an outward push of a cosmological constant whose dark energy contributes about 70% of the critical density. This is a remarkable number. If it's correct, then not only does ordinary matter, protons, neutrons, electrons, constitute a paltry 5% of the mass energy of the universe, and not only does some currently unidentified form of dark matter constitute at least 5 times that amount, but also the majority of the mass energy in the universe is contributed by a totally different and rather mysterious form of dark energy that is spread throughout space. If these ideas are right, they dramatically extend the Copernican revolution. Not only are we not the center of the universe, but the stuff of which we're made is like flotsam on the cosmic ocean. If protons, neutrons, and electrons had been left out of the grand design, the total mass energy of the universe would hardly have been diminished. But there is a second, equally important reason why 70% is a remarkable number. A cosmological constant that contributes 70% of the critical density would, together with the 30% coming from ordinary matter and dark matter, bring the total mass energy of the universe right up to the full 100% predicted by inflationary cosmology. Thus, the outward push demonstrated by the supernova data can be explained by just the right amount of dark energy to account for the unseen 70% of the universe that inflationary cosmologists had been scratching their heads over. The supernova measurements and inflationary cosmology are wonderfully complementary. They confirm each other. Each provides a corroborating second opinion for the other. Combining the observational results of supernovae with the theoretical insights of inflation, we thus arrive at the following sketch of cosmic evolution. Early on, the energy of the universe was carried by the inflaton field, which was perched away from its minimum energy state. Because of its negative pressure, the inflaton field drove an enormous burst of inflationary expansion. Then, some 10 to the minus 35th power seconds later, as the inflaton field slid down its potential energy ball, the burst of expansion drew to a close, and the inflaton released its pent-up energy to the production of ordinary matter and radiation. For many billions of years, these familiar constituents of the universe exerted an ordinary attractive gravitational pull that slowed the spatial expansion. But as the universe grew and thinned out, the gravitational pull diminished. About 7 billion years ago, ordinary gravitational attraction became weak enough for the gravitational repulsion of the universe's cosmological constant to become dominant. And since then, the rate of spatial expansion has been continually increasing. About 100 billion years from now, all but the closest of galaxies will be dragged away by the swelling space at faster-than-light speed, and so would be impossible for us to see, regardless of the power of telescopes used. If these ideas are right, then, in the far future, the universe will be a vast, empty, and lonely place. Puzzles and progress. With these discoveries, it thus seemed manifest that the pieces of the cosmological puzzle were falling into place. Questions left unanswered by the standard Big Bang theory: what ignited the outward swelling of space? Why is the temperature of the microwave background radiation so uniform? Why does space seem to have a flat shape? Were addressed by the inflationary theory. Even so, thorny issues regarding fundamental origins have continued to mount. Was there an era before the inflationary burst? And if so, what was it like? What introduced an inflaton field, displaced from its lowest energy configuration, to initiate the inflationary expansion? And, the newest question of all, why is the universe apparently composed of such a mishmash of ingredients? 5% familiar matter, 25% dark matter, 70% dark energy. Despite the immensely pleasing fact that this cosmic recipe agrees with inflation's prediction that the universe should have 100% of the critical density, and although it simultaneously explains the accelerated expansion found by supernova studies, many physicists view the hodgepodge composition as distinctly unattractive. Why, many have asked, has the universe's composition turned out to be so complicated? Why are there a handful of disparate ingredients in such seemingly random abundances? Is there some sensible underlying plan that theoretical studies have yet to reveal? No one has advanced any convincing answers to these questions. They are among the pressing research problems driving current cosmological research, and they serve to remind us of the many tangled knots we must still unravel before we can claim to have fully understood the birth of the universe. But, despite the significant challenges that remain, inflation is far and away the front-running cosmological theory. To be sure, physicists' belief in inflation is grounded in the achievements we've so far discussed. But the confidence in inflationary cosmology has roots that run deeper still. As we'll see in the next chapter, a number of other considerations, coming from both observational and theoretical discoveries, have convinced many physicists who work in the field that the inflationary framework is our generation's most important and most lasting contribution to cosmological science. Chapter 11. Quanta in the Sky with Diamonds. Inflation, Quantum Jitters, and the Arrow of Time. The discovery of the inflationary framework launched a new era in cosmological research, and in the decades since, many thousands of papers have been written on the subject. Scientists have explored just about every nook and cranny of the theory you could possibly imagine. While many of these works have focused on details of technical importance, others have gone further and shown how inflation not only solves specific cosmological problems beyond the reach of the standard Big Bang, but also provides powerful new approaches to a number of age-old questions. Of these, there are three developments, having to do with the formation of clumpy structures such as galaxies, the amount of energy required to spawn the universe we see, and, of prime importance to our story, the origin of time's arrow, on which inflation has ushered in substantial and, some would say, spectacular progress. Let's take a look. Quantum skywriting. Inflationary cosmology's solution to the horizon and flatness problems was its initial claim to fame, and rightly so. As we've seen, these were major accomplishments. But in the years since, many physicists have come to believe that another of inflation's achievements shares the top spot on the list of the theory's most important contributions. The lauded insight concerns an issue that, to this point, I have encouraged you not to think about. How is it that there are galaxies, stars, planets, and other clumpy things in the universe? In the last three chapters, I asked you to focus on astronomically large scales, scales on which the universe appears homogeneous, scales so large that entire galaxies can be thought of as single H2O molecules, while the universe itself is the whole uniform glass of water. But sooner or later, cosmology has to come to grips with the fact that when you examine the cosmos on finer scales, you discover clumpy structures such as galaxies. And here, once again, we are faced with a puzzle. If the universe is indeed smooth, uniform, and homogeneous on large scales, features that are supported by observation, and that lie at the heart of all cosmological analyses, where could the smaller-scale lumpiness have come from? The staunch believer in standard Big Bang cosmology can, once again, shrug off this question by appealing to highly favorable and mysteriously tuned conditions in the early universe. Near the very beginning, such a believer can say, things were, by and large, smooth and uniform, but not perfectly uniform. How conditions got that way, I can't say. That's just how it was back then. Over time, this tiny lumpiness grew, since a lump has greater gravitational pull, being denser than its surroundings, and therefore grabs hold of more nearby material, growing larger still. Ultimately, the lumps got big enough to form stars and galaxies. This would be a convincing story, were it not for two deficiencies. The utter lack of an explanation for either the initial overall homogeneity or these important, tiny, non-uniformities. That's where inflationary cosmology provides gratifying progress. We've already seen that inflation offers an explanation for the large-scale uniformity. And as we'll now learn, the explanatory power of the theory goes even further. Remarkably, according to inflationary cosmology, the initial non-uniformity that ultimately resulted in the formation of stars and galaxies came from quantum mechanics. This magnificent idea arises from an interplay between two seemingly disparate areas of physics: the inflationary expansion of space and the quantum uncertainty principle. The uncertainty principle tells us that there are always trade-offs in how sharply various complementary physical features in the cosmos can be determined. The most familiar example, see Chapter 4, involves matter. The more precisely the position of a particle is determined, the less precisely its velocity can be determined. But the uncertainty principle also applies to fields. By essentially the same reasoning we used in its application to particles, the uncertainty principle implies that the more precisely the value of a field is determined at one location in space, the less precisely its rate of change at that location can be determined. The position of a particle and the rate of change of its position, its velocity, play analogous roles in quantum mechanics to the value of a field and the rate of change of the field value at a given location in space. I like to summarize the uncertainty principle by saying, roughly speaking, that quantum mechanics makes things jittery and turbulent. If the velocity of a particle can't be delineated with total precision, we also can't delineate where the particle will be located even a fraction of a second later, since velocity now determines position then. In a sense, the particle is free to take on this or that velocity, or more precisely, to assume a mixture of many different velocities, and hence it will jitter frantically, haphazardly going this way and that. For fields, the situation is similar. If a field's rate of change can't be delineated with total precision, then we also can't delineate what the value of the field will be at any location, even a moment later. In a sense, the field will undulate up or down at this or that speed. Or, more precisely, it will assume a strange mixture of many different rates of change, and hence its value will undergo a frenzied, fuzzy, random jitter. In daily life, we aren't directly aware of the jitters, either for particles or fields, because they take place on subatomic scales. But that's where inflation makes a big impact. The sudden burst of inflationary expansion stretched space by such an enormous factor that what initially inhabited the microscopic was drawn out to the macroscopic. As a key example, pioneers of inflationary cosmology realized that random differences between the quantum jitters in one spatial location and another would have generated slight inhomogeneities in the microscopic realm. because of the indiscriminate quantum agitation, the amount of energy in one location would have been a bit different from what it was in another. Then, through the subsequent inflationary swelling of space, these tiny variations would have been stretched to scales far larger than the quantum domain, yielding a small amount of lumpiness, much as tiny wiggles drawn on a balloon with a magic marker are stretched clear across the balloon's surface when you blow it up. This, physicists believe, is the origin of the lumpiness that the staunch believer in the standard Big Bang model simply declares, without justification, to be how it was back then. Through the enormous stretching of inevitable quantum fluctuations, inflationary cosmology provides an explanation. Inflationary expansion stretches tiny, inhomogeneous quantum jitters and smears them clear across the sky. Over the few billion years following the end of the brief inflationary phase, these tiny lumps continued to grow through gravitational clumping. Just as in the standard Big Bang picture, lumps have slightly higher gravitational pull than their surroundings, so they draw in nearby material, growing larger still. In time, the lumps grew large enough to yield the matter making up galaxies and the stars that inhabit them. Certainly, there are numerous steps of detail in going from a little lump to a galaxy, and many still need elucidation. But the overall framework is clear. In a quantum world, nothing is ever perfectly uniform because of the jitteriness inherent to the uncertainty principle. And in a quantum world that experienced inflationary expansion, such non-uniformity can be stretched from the micro-world to far larger scales, providing the seeds for the formation of large astrophysical bodies like galaxies. That's the basic idea, so feel free to skip over the next paragraph. But for those who are interested, I'd like to make the discussion a bit more precise. Recall that inflationary expansion came to an end when the inflaton field's value slid down its potential energy bowl and the field relinquished all its pent-up energy and negative pressure. We described this as happening uniformly throughout space. The inflaton value here, there, and everywhere experienced the same evolution, as that's what naturally emerges from the governing equations. However, this is strictly true only if we ignore the effects of quantum mechanics. On average, the inflaton field value did indeed slide down the bowl, as we expect from thinking about a simple classical object like a marble rolling down an incline. But just as a frog sliding down the bowl is likely to jump and jiggle along the way, quantum mechanics tells us that the inflaton field experienced quivers and jitters. On its way down, the value may have suddenly jumped up a little bit over there, or jiggled down a little bit over there. And because of this jittering, the inflaton reached the value of lowest energy at different places at slightly different moments. In turn, inflationary expansion shut off at slightly different times at different locations in space, so that the amount of spatial expansion at different locations varied slightly, giving rise to inhomogeneities, wrinkles, similar to the kind you see when the pizza maker stretches the dough a bit more in one place than another and creates a little bump. Now, the normal intuition is that jitters arising from quantum mechanics would be too small to be relevant on astrophysical scales. But with inflation, space expanded at such a colossal rate, doubling in size every 10^-37th power seconds, that even a slightly different duration of inflation at nearby locations resulted in a significant wrinkle. In fact, calculations undertaken in specific realizations of inflation have shown that the inhomogeneities produced in this way have a tendency to be too large. Researchers often have to adjust details in a given inflationary model, the precise shape of the inflaton field's potential energy ball, to ensure that the quantum jitters don't predict a universe that's too lumpy. And so inflationary cosmology supplies a ready-made mechanism for understanding how the small-scale non-uniformity responsible for lumpy structures like stars and galaxies emerged in a universe that, on the largest of scales, appears thoroughly homogeneous. According to inflation, the more than 100 billion galaxies sparkling throughout space like heavenly diamonds are nothing but quantum mechanics writ large across the sky. To me, this realization is one of the greatest wonders of the modern scientific age. The Golden Age of Cosmology. Dramatic evidence supporting these ideas comes from meticulous satellite-based observations of the microwave background radiation's temperature. I have emphasized a number of times that the temperature of the radiation in one part of the sky agrees with that in another to high accuracy. But what I have yet to mention is that by the fourth digit after the decimal place, the temperatures in different locations do differ. Precision measurements, first accomplished in 1992 by COBE, the Cosmic Background Explorer satellite, and more recently by WMAP, the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, have determined that while the temperature might be 2.7249 Kelvin in one spot in space, it might be 2.7250 Kelvin in another, and 2.7251 Kelvin in still another. The wonderful thing is that these extraordinarily small temperature variations follow a pattern on the sky that can be explained by attributing them to the same mechanism that has been suggested for seeding galaxy formation: quantum fluctuations stretched out by inflation. The rough idea is that when tiny quantum jitters are smeared across space, they make it slightly hotter in one region and slightly cooler in another. Photons received from a slightly denser region expend more energy overcoming the slightly stronger gravitational field, and hence their energy and temperature are slightly lower than those of photons received from a less dense region. Physicists have carried out precise calculations based on this proposal and generated predictions for how the microwave radiation's temperature should vary from place to place across the sky. When these predictions are compared with satellite observations, there is extraordinary agreement. I hope you're blown away by this concordance of theory and observation, because if not, it means I've failed to convey the full wonder of the result. So, just in case, let me re-emphasize what's going on here. Satellite-borne telescopes have recently measured the temperature of microwave photons that have been traveling toward us, unimpeded, for nearly 14 billion years. They found that photons arriving from different directions in space have nearly identical temperatures, differing by no more than a few 10,000ths of a degree. Moreover, the observations have shown that these tiny temperature differences fill out a particular pattern on the sky. And, marvel of marvels, calculations done today, using the inflationary framework, are able to explain the pattern of these minuscule temperature variations, variations set down nearly 14 billion years ago. And to top it off, the key to this explanation involves jitters arising from quantum uncertainty. Wow! This success has convinced many physicists of the inflationary theory's validity. What is of equal importance, these and other precision astronomical measurements, which have only recently become possible, have allowed cosmology to mature from a field based on speculation and conjecture to one firmly grounded in observation. A coming of age that has inspired many in the field to call our era the Golden Age of Cosmology. Creating a universe. With such progress, physicists have been motivated to see how much further inflationary cosmology can go. Can it, for example, resolve the ultimate mystery encapsulated in Leibniz's question of why there is a universe at all? Well, at least with our current level of understanding, that's asking for too much. Even if a cosmological theory were to make headway on this question, we could ask why that particular theory, its assumptions, ingredients, and equations, was relevant, thus merely pushing the question of origin one step further back. If logic alone somehow required the universe to exist and to be governed by a unique set of laws with unique ingredients, then perhaps we'd have a convincing story. But to date, that's nothing but a pipe dream. A related but somewhat less ambitious question, one that has also been asked in various guises through the ages, is, where did all the mass, energy, making up the universe come from? Here, although inflationary cosmology does not provide a complete answer, it has cast the question in an intriguing new light. To understand how, think of a huge but flexible box filled with many thousands of swarming children, incessantly running and jumping. Imagine that the box is completely impermeable, so no heat or energy can escape. But because it's flexible, its walls can move outward. As the children relentlessly slam into each of the box's walls, hundreds at a time, with hundreds more immediately to follow, the box steadily expands. Now, you might expect that because the walls are impermeable, the total energy embodied by the swarming children will stay fully within the expanding box. After all, where else could their energy go? Well, although a reasonable proposition, it's not quite right. There is some place for it to go. The children expend energy every time they slam into a wall, and much of this energy is transferred to the wall's motion. The very expansion of the box absorbs, and hence depletes, the children's energy. Now, imagine that a few pranksters among the children decide to change things a bit. They hook a number of enormous rubber bands between each of the opposite outward-moving box walls. The rubber bands exert an inward, negative pressure on the box walls, which has exactly the opposite effect of the children's outward positive pressure. Rather than transferring energy to the expansion of the box, the rubber band's negative pressure saps energy from the expansion. As the box expands, the rubber bands get increasingly taut, which means they embody increasing amounts of energy. Of course, our real interest is not with expanding boxes, but with the expanding universe. And our theories tell us that space is filled not with swarms of children and scores of rubber bands, but, depending on the cosmological epoch, with a uniform motion of inflaton field, or a stew of ordinary particles, electrons, photons, protons, etc. Nevertheless, a simple observation allows us to carry over to cosmology the conclusions we've reached in the setting of the box. Just as the fast-moving children work against the inward force exerted by the box's wall as it expands, the fast-moving particles in our universe work against an inward force as space expands. They work against the force of gravity. This suggests, and the mathematics confirms, that we can analogize between the universe and the box by substituting the force of gravity for the box's walls. Thus, just as the total energy embodied by the children drops because it's continuously transferred to the energy of the walls as the box expands, the total energy carried by ordinary particles of matter and radiation drops because it's continuously transferred to gravity as the universe expands. Furthermore, we've learned that just as the prankster's rubber bands exert a negative pressure within the expanding box, a uniform inflaton field exerts a negative pressure within the expanding universe. And so, just as the total energy embodied by the rubber bands increases as the box expands, because they extract energy from the box's walls, the total energy embodied by the inflaton field increases as the universe expands, because it gains energy from gravity. To summarize, as the universe expands, matter and radiation lose energy to gravity, while an inflaton field gains energy from gravity. The pivotal nature of these observations becomes clear when we try to explain the origin of the matter and radiation that make up galaxies, stars, and everything else inhabiting the cosmos. In the standard Big Bang theory, the mass, energy, carried by matter and radiation has steadily decreased as the universe has expanded. And so the mass, energy in the early universe greatly exceeded what we see today. Thus, instead of offering an explanation for where all the mass, energy currently inhabiting the universe originated, the standard Big Bang fights an unending uphill battle. The farther back the theory looks, the more mass energy it must somehow explain. In inflationary cosmology, though, much the opposite is true. Recall that the inflationary theory argues that matter and radiation were produced at the end of the inflationary phase as the inflaton field released its pent-up energy by rolling from perch to valley in its potential energy bowl. The relevant question, therefore, is whether, just as the inflationary phase was drawing to a close, the theory can account for the inflaton field embodying the stupendous quantity of mass energy necessary to yield the matter and radiation in today's universe. The answer to this question is that inflation can, without even breaking a sweat. As just explained, the inflaton field is a gravitational parasite. It feeds on gravity. And so the total energy the inflaton field carried increased as space expanded. More precisely, the mathematical analysis shows that the energy density of the inflaton field remained constant throughout the inflationary phase of rapid expansion, implying that the total energy it embodied grew in direct proportion to the volume of the space it filled. In the previous chapter, we saw that the size of the universe increased by at least a factor of 10 to the 30th power during inflation, which means the volume of the universe increased by a factor of at least 10 to the 30th power cubed, or 10 to the 90th power. Consequently, the energy embodied in the inflaton field increased by the same huge factor. As the inflationary phase drew to a close, a mere 10 to the minus 35th power or so seconds after it began, the energy in the inflaton field grew by a factor on the order of 10 to the 90th power, if not more. This means that, at the onset of inflation, the inflaton field didn't need to have much energy, since the enormous expansion it was about to spawn would enormously amplify the energy it carried. A simple calculation shows that a tiny nugget, on the order of 10 to the minus 26th power centimeters across, filled with a uniform inflaton field, and weighing a mere 20 pounds, would, through the ensuing inflationary expansion, acquire enough energy to account for all we see in the universe today. Thus, in stark contrast to the standard Big Bang theory, in which the total mass energy of the early universe was huge beyond words, inflationary cosmology, by mining gravity, can produce all the ordinary matter and radiation in the universe from a tiny 20-pound speck of inflaton-filled space. By no means does this answer Leibniz's question of why there is something rather than nothing, since we've yet to explain why there is an inflaton, or even the space it occupies. But the something in need of explanation weighs a whole lot less than my dog Rocky, and that's certainly a very different starting point than envisaged in the standard Big Bang. Inflation, smoothness, and the arrow of time. Perhaps my enthusiasm has already betrayed my bias, but of all the progress that science has achieved in our age, advances in cosmology fill me with the greatest awe and humility. I seem never to have lost the rush I initially felt years ago when I first read up on the basics of general relativity and realized that from our tiny little corner of space-time, we can apply Einstein's theory to learn about the evolution of the entire cosmos. Now, a few decades later, technological progress is subjecting these once abstract proposals for how the universe behaved in its earliest moments to observational tests, and the theories really work. Recall, though, that besides cosmology's overall relevance to the story of space and time, chapters 6 and 7 launched us into a study of the universe's early history with a specific goal: to find the origin of time's arrow. Remember from those chapters that the only convincing framework we found for explaining time's arrow was that the early universe had extremely high order, that is, extremely low entropy, which set the stage for a future in which entropy got ever larger. Just as the pages of War and Peace wouldn't have had the capacity to get increasingly jumbled if they had not been nice and ordered at some point, so too the universe wouldn't have had the capacity to get increasingly disordered. Milk spilling, eggs breaking, people aging, unless it had been in a highly ordered configuration early on. The puzzle we encountered is to explain how this high-order, low-entropy starting point came to be. Inflationary cosmology offers substantial progress, but let me first remind you more precisely of the puzzle, in case any of the relevant details have slipped your mind. There is strong evidence and little doubt that early in the history of the universe, matter was spread uniformly throughout space. Ordinarily, this would be characterized as a high-entropy configuration, like the carbon dioxide molecules from a bottle of Coke being spread uniformly throughout a room, and hence would be so commonplace that it would hardly require an explanation. But when gravity matters, as it does when considering the entire universe, a uniform distribution of matter is a rare, low-entropy, highly ordered configuration, because gravity drives matter to form clumps. Similarly, a smooth and uniform spatial curvature also has very low entropy. It is highly ordered compared with a wildly bumpy, non-uniform spatial curvature. Just as there are many ways for the pages of War and Peace to be disordered, but only one way for them to be ordered, so there are many ways for space to have a disordered, non-uniform shape, but very few ways in which it can be fully ordered, smooth, and uniform. So, we are left to puzzle. Why did the early universe have a low entropy, highly ordered, uniform distribution of matter, instead of a high entropy, highly disordered, clumpy distribution of matter, such as a diverse population of black holes? And why was the curvature of space smooth, ordered, and uniform to extremely high accuracy, rather than being riddled with a variety of huge warps and severe curves, also like those generated by black holes? As first discussed in detail by Paul Davies and Don Page, inflationary cosmology gives important insight into these issues. To see how, bear in mind that an essential assumption of the puzzle is that once a clump forms here or there, its greater gravitational pull attracts yet more material, causing it to grow larger. Correspondingly, once a wrinkle in space forms here or there, its greater gravitational pull tends to make the wrinkle yet more severe, leading to a bumpy, highly non-uniform spatial curvature. When gravity matters, ordinary, unremarkable, high-entropy configurations are lumpy and bumpy. But note the following. This reasoning relies completely on the attractive nature of ordinary gravity. Lumps and bumps grow because they pull strongly on nearby material, coaxing such material to join the lump. During the brief inflationary phase, though, gravity was repulsive, and that changed everything. Take the shape of space. The enormous outward push of repulsive gravity drove space to swell so swiftly that initial bumps and warps were stretched smooth, much as fully inflating a shriveled balloon stretches out its creased surface. What's more, since the volume of space increased by a colossal factor during the brief inflationary period, the density of any clumps of matter was completely diluted, much as the density of fish in your aquarium would be diluted if the tank's volume suddenly increased to that of an Olympic swimming pool. Thus, although attractive gravity causes clumps of matter and creases of space to grow, repulsive gravity does the opposite. It causes them to diminish, leading to an ever smoother, ever more uniform outcome. Thus, by the end of the inflationary burst, the size of the universe had grown fantastically. Any non-uniformity in the curvature of space had been stretched away, and any initial clumps of anything at all had been diluted to the point of irrelevance. Moreover, as the inflaton field slid down to the bottom of its potential energy bowl, bringing the burst of inflationary expansion to a close, it converted its pent-up energy into a nearly uniform bath of particles of ordinary matter throughout space. Uniform up to the tiny but critical inhomogeneities coming from quantum jitters. In total, this all sounds like great progress. The outcome we've reached via inflation, a smooth, uniform spatial expansion populated by a nearly uniform distribution of matter, was exactly what we were trying to explain. It's exactly the low entropy configuration that we need to explain time zero. Entropy and inflation. Indeed, this is significant progress. But two important issues remain. First, we seem to be concluding that the inflationary burst smooths things out, and hence lowers total entropy, embodying a physical mechanism, not just a statistical fluke, that appears to violate the second law of thermodynamics. Were that the case, either our understanding of the second law or our current reasoning would have to be an error. In actuality, though, we don't have to face either of these options, because total entropy does not go down as a result of inflation. What really happens during the inflationary burst is that the total entropy goes up, but it goes up much less than it might have. You see, by the end of the inflationary phase, space was stretched smooth, and so the gravitational contribution to entropy, the entropy associated with the possible bumpy, non-ordered, non-uniform shape of space, was minimal. However, when the inflaton field slid down its bowl and relinquished its pent-up energy, it is estimated to have produced about 10 to the 80th power particles of matter and radiation. Such a huge number of particles, like a book with a huge number of pages, embodies a huge amount of entropy. Thus, even though the gravitational entropy went down, the increase in entropy from the production of all these particles more than compensated. The total entropy increased, just as we expect from the second law. But, and this is the important point, the inflationary burst, by smoothing out space and ensuring a homogeneous, uniform, low-entropy gravitational field, created a huge gap between what the entropy contribution from gravity was and what it might have been. Overall entropy increased during inflation, but by a paltry amount compared with how much it could have increased. It's in this sense that inflation generated a low-entropy universe. By the end of inflation, entropy had increased, but by nowhere near the factor by which the spatial expanse had increased. If entropy is likened to property taxes, it would be as if New York City acquired the Sahara Desert. The total property taxes collected would go up, but by a tiny amount compared with the total increase in acreage. Ever since the end of inflation, gravity has been trying to make up the entropy difference. Every clump, be it a galaxy, or a star in a galaxy, or a planet, or a black hole, that gravity has subsequently coaxed out of the uniformity, seeded by the tiny non-uniformity from quantum jitters, has increased entropy and has brought gravity one step closer to realizing its entropy potential. In this sense, then, inflation is a mechanism that yielded a large universe with relatively low gravitational entropy, and in that way set the stage for the subsequent billions of years of gravitational clumping, whose effects we now witness. And so inflationary cosmology gives a direction to time's arrow by generating a past with exceedingly low gravitational entropy. The future is the direction in which this entropy grows. The second issue becomes apparent when we continue down the path to which time's arrow led us in Chapter 6. From an egg to the chicken that laid it, to the chicken's feed, to the plant kingdom, to the sun's heat and light, to the Big Bang's uniformly distributed primordial gas, we followed the universe's evolution into a past that had ever greater order, at each stage pushing the puzzle of low entropy one step further back in time. We have just now realized that an even earlier stage of inflationary expansion can naturally explain the smooth and uniform aftermath of the bang. But what about inflation itself? Can we explain the initial link in this chain we've followed? Can we explain why conditions were right for an inflationary burst to happen at all? This is an issue of paramount importance. No matter how many puzzles inflationary cosmology resolves in theory, if an era of inflationary expansion never took place, the approach will be rendered irrelevant. Moreover, since we can't go back to the early universe and determine directly whether inflation occurred, assessing whether we've made real progress in setting a direction to time's arrow requires that we determine the likelihood that the conditions necessary for an inflationary burst were achieved. That is, physicists bristle at the standard Big Bang's reliance on finely tuned homogeneous initial conditions that, while observationally motivated, are theoretically unexplained. It feels deeply unsatisfying for the low entropy state of the early universe simply to be assumed. It feels hollow for time's arrow to be imposed on the universe without explanation. At first blush, inflation offers progress by showing that what's assumed in the standard Big Bang emerges from inflationary evolution. But if the initiation of inflation requires yet other, highly special, exceedingly low entropy conditions, we will pretty much find ourselves back at square one. We will merely have traded the Big Bang's special conditions for those necessary to ignite inflation. And the puzzle of time's arrow will remain just as puzzling. What are the conditions necessary for inflation? We've seen that inflation is the inevitable result of the inflaton field's value getting stuck, for just a moment, and within just a tiny region, on the high-energy plateau in its potential energy bowl. Our charge, therefore, is to determine how likely this starting configuration for inflation actually is. If initiating inflation proves easy, we'll be in great shape. But if the necessary conditions are extraordinarily unlikely to be attained, we will merely have shifted the question of time's arrow one step further back, to finding the explanation for the low-entropy inflaton field configuration that got the ball rolling. I'll first describe current thinking on this issue in the most optimistic light, and then return to essential elements of the story that remain cloudy. Boltzmann redux. As mentioned in the previous chapter, the inflationary burst is best thought of as an event occurring in a pre-existing universe, rather than being thought of as the creation of the universe itself. Although we don't have an unassailable understanding of what the universe was like during such a pre-inflationary era, let's see how far we can get if we assume that things were in a thoroughly ordinary, high-entropy state. Specifically, let's imagine that primordial pre-inflationary space was riddled with warps and bumps, and that the inflaton field was also highly disordered, its value jumping to and fro like the frog in the hot metal bowl. Now, just as you can expect that if you patiently play a fair slot machine, sooner or later the randomly spinning dials will land on triple diamonds, we expect that sooner or later a chance fluctuation within this highly energetic, turbulent arena of the primordial universe will cause the inflaton field's value to jump to the correct uniform value in some small nugget of space, initiating an outward burst of inflationary expansion. As explained in the previous section, calculations show that the nugget of space need only have been tiny, on the order of 10 to the minus 26th power centimeters across, for the ensuing cosmological expansion, inflationary expansion followed by standard Big Bang expansion, to have stretched it larger than the universe we see today. Thus, rather than assuming or simply declaring that conditions in the early universe were right for inflationary expansion to take place, in this way of thinking about things, an ultra-microscopic fluctuation weighing a mere 20 pounds, occurring within an ordinary, unremarkable environment of disorder, gave rise to the necessary conditions. What's more, just as the slot machine will also generate a wide variety of non-winning results, in other regions of primordial space, other kinds of inflaton fluctuations would also have happened. In most, the fluctuation wouldn't have had the right value or have been sufficiently uniform for inflationary expansion to occur. Even in a region that's a mere 10 to the minus 26th power centimeters across, a field's value can vary wildly. But all that matters to us is that there was one nugget that yielded the space-smoothing inflationary burst that provided the first link in the low-entropy chain, ultimately leading to our familiar cosmos. As we see only our one big universe, we only need the cosmic slot machine to pay out once. Since we are tracing the universe back to a statistical fluctuation from primordial chaos, this explanation for time's arrow shares certain features with Boltzmann's original proposal. Remember from Chapter 6 that Boltzmann suggested that everything we now see arose as a rare but every so often expectable fluctuation from total disorder. The problem with Boltzmann's original formulation, though, was that it could not explain why the chance fluctuation had gone so far overboard and produced a universe hugely more ordered than it would need to be even to support life as we know it. Why is the universe so vast, having billions and billions of galaxies, each with billions and billions of stars, when it could have drastically cut corners by having, say, just a few galaxies, or even only one? From the statistical point of view, a more modest fluctuation that produced some order, but not as much as we currently see, would be far more likely. Moreover, since on average entropy is on the rise, Boltzmann's reasoning suggests that it would be much more likely that everything we see today just now arose as a rare statistical jump to lower entropy. Recall the reason. The farther back the fluctuation happened, the lower the entropy it would have had to attain. Entropy starts to rise after any dip to low entropy. So if the fluctuation happened yesterday, it must have dipped down to yesterday's lower entropy. And if it happened a billion years ago, it must have dipped down to that era's even lower entropy. Hence, the farther back in time, the more drastic and improbable the required fluctuation. Thus, it is much more likely that the jump just happened. But if we accept this conclusion, we can't trust memories, records, or even the laws of physics that underlie the discussion itself. A completely intolerable position. The tremendous advantage of the inflationary incarnation of Boltzmann's idea is that a small fluctuation early on, a modest jump to the favorable conditions within a tiny nugget of space, inevitably yields the huge and ordered universe we are aware of. Once inflationary expansion set in, the little nugget was inexorably stretched to scales at least as large as the universe we currently see. And hence, there is no mystery as to why the universe didn't cut corners. There is no mystery why the universe is vast and is populated by a huge number of galaxies. From the get-go, inflation gave the universe an amazing deal. A jump to lower entropy within a tiny nugget of space was leveraged by inflationary expansion into the vast reaches of the cosmos. And, of utmost importance, the inflationary stretching didn't just yield any old large universe. It yielded our large universe. Inflation explains the shape of space. It explains the large-scale uniformity. And it even explains the smaller-scale inhomogeneities, such as galaxies and temperature variations in the background radiation. Inflation packages a wealth of explanatory and predictive power in a single fluctuation to low entropy. And so Boltzmann may well have been right. Everything we see may have resulted from a chance fluctuation out of a highly disordered state of primeval chaos. In this realization of his ideas, though, we can trust our records and we can trust our memories. The fluctuation did not happen just now. The past really happened. Our records are records of things that took place. Inflationary expansion amplifies a tiny speck of order in the early universe. It wound up the universe to a huge expanse with minimal gravitational entropy. So the 14 billion years of subsequent unwinding, of subsequent clumping into galaxies, stars, and planets, presents no puzzle. In fact, this approach even tells us a bit more. Just as it's possible to hit the jackpot on a number of slot machines on the floor of the Bellagio, in the primordial state of high entropy and overall chaos, there was no reason why the conditions necessary for inflationary expansion would arise only in a single spatial nugget. Instead, as André Lind has proposed, there could have been many nuggets scattered here and there that underwent space-smoothing inflationary expansion. If that were so, our universe would be but one among many that sprouted, and perhaps continue to sprout, when chance fluctuations made the conditions right for an inflationary burst. As these and other universes would likely be forever separate from ours, it's hard to imagine how we would ever establish whether this multiverse picture is true. However, as a conceptual framework, it's both rich and tantalizing. Among other things, it suggests a possible shift in how we think about cosmology. In Chapter 10, I described inflation as a front end